welcome listeners to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, and here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm a health, food, and environmental journalist for over two decades, reporting on Alternet, EcoWatch, The Huffington Post, Intent.com, and other locations. Every week on Connect the Dots, we cover the connection between our personal health and our total health environment, covering different facets of all the things that impact our health, all the way from the quality of our food, water, air, and earth, to the quality of our health care, to the social policies that make us safe and protect us or advance the kinds of health initiatives, healthy foods, and healthy environmental resources we need to thrive. So every week on the show, I talk to different doctors, experts, authors, thought leaders, advocates, activists, and writers about different aspects of the manifold things and the manifold features from the context and factors from the context that affect our health. And actually, this is part of, we have several weeks of really terrific guests, and we're going to be talking a lot about personal health and how it interfaces a great deal on the several upcoming shows, beginning with this one. Today, my guest, I'm so thrilled to have her, is Victoria Mazes. I've interviewed her in the past, and her work is just exceptional. She's the executive director of the Arizona Center for Integrative Medicine and professor of clinical medicine, family medicine, and public health. That is an that is a very terrific combo if you really think about it, because a lot of what we talk about on this show is the gap between clinical medicine and public health initiatives and policies. You know, one of the things that I also want to mention that's very interesting is very often, as I write in the blogosphere, when I cover, as I do, the rationale and science of integrative medicine, very often people who are unfamiliar with it, which probably doesn't include a lot of the listeners here on this program on this network, but a lot of people who are unfamiliar with it somehow think it's very hazy or vague or woo-woo. And one of the things about Dr. Mazes is that she's both a clinician and a scientist who really kind of has the facts at her fingertips about the science, the logic, and the rationale for integrative medicine. So we're going to be discussing not only that foundational stuff, but also how that helps us look at the impact upon our health of the environment and the kinds of health treatments and public health policies that we so frequently cover on this program. She'll really be able to elucidate that for us today, which I'm really excited about. In addition, I just want to mention that Dr. Mazes is also the author of the book Be Fruitful, The Essential Guide to Maximizing Fertility and Giving Birth to a Healthy Child. So we'll also be discussing that on today's program because, you know, one of the things that we've seen in the concerns over various myriad different environmental toxins and chemicals that show up in agriculture, personal care products, or even large industrial processes like fracking or other things that I've covered a great deal on this program, is that their impact is particularly acute on infants, babies, children, people, you know, the people who are it's still developing and growing, you know, experience greater impacts from toxicity than do adults who are already kind of formed. And so Dr. Mazes' book is really a great resource for people looking to conceive and to raise healthy children. So that's a full plate, and I, you know, so just tune in, and then I think you'll really enjoy this program. So welcome, Dr. Mazes, to Connect the Dots. It's so wonderful to have you here.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be on your show.
So, you know, we have quite a range of topics we're covering here. So let's begin with talking about, because I know that at the Arizona Center for Integrative Medicine, you've really been quite pioneering in really looking into and beginning, real research and understanding of the actual role of environmental toxins and their impact on health and risk factors for disease. This is something that kind of people have a vague sense is sort of going on out there, but there's sort of too many things to really consider, but they do need to be considered. So I'd love to hear from you why you feel that this has been a special area of study that's important to undertake, and then we can go on from there to discuss what you're, what you are finding, what science is finding out about this.
Well, as you are well aware, Allison, one of the fundamental principles of integrative medicine is to focus on prevention and health promotion. And it's interesting, in this moment of the Affordable Care Act, there has been a lot bandied around about prevention, but often when you drill down, the conversation is focused on screening tests for cancer and what I would call chemo prevention, which would be something like taking an aspirin to prevent a heart attack. And we certainly can value those aspects of prevention, but I think if we want to look at primary prevention, we really have to look at what helps human beings be healthier. And so in general, we know that the influence of lifestyle, of what people eat, of whether they exercise and if they're overweight and whether they smoke, it was estimated in a 2009 article in the Archives of Internal Medicine that 78% of chronic disease could be prevented if people followed a healthy lifestyle. But once again, if you're really going to look at primary prevention, then it turns out there's no more important time to think about this than when a couple starts thinking about conceiving a child, because we know from the fetal origins hypothesis that the experience in the womb, those 9 months, wire a human being for a lifetime of hopefully better, but sometimes, unfortunately, worse health. And so we really need couples to clean up that vessel that's going to create and contain human life before pregnancy occurs if we care, if we deeply care about prevention.
And so in your book, you have techniques about for doing that. How toxic is our current environment? In other words, what you're talking about is, kind of minimizing a whole host of things that we can minimize, and maybe people are unaware of them or they feel, oh, well, this is so much trouble, I can't do everything. Can you give some examples of just a few things that people could do and the difference they might make?
Yes. Well, to answer your first question, it does turn out that there are a lot of toxins in people, and we have evidence from multiple sources. But the most recent and I think startling was that there was a joint opinion statement that was released by the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology and also the American Society for Reproductive Medicine. And this happened just in September. And they basically said that patient exposure to toxic environmental chemicals and other stressors is ubiquitous. And all pregnant women are exposed. And then they basically went on to say that, therefore, doctors need to counsel patients before they get pregnant or during their prenatal visits. Now, it's too late if you're in your prenatal visit because the influence is very early in terms of the developing nervous system, the developing cardiovascular systems. These are very well developed by 12 weeks, which is when many people have their first prenatal visit. And so we really have to get people on board before they conceive for the best possible outcome. We know from a 2008 study that when babies are born, and this was a small study, but the average number of chemicals in the baby's blood before they had taken a single breath of air was 200. And the Institute of Medicine and the President's Cancer Panel used what I thought was incredibly strong language. They said babies are being born pre-polluted. Mm-hmm. So we have very strong data on the the problem that we're in, the current problem. What I try to do in Be Fruitful and in other places that I've written and on the website I created is to give strategies that allow men and women to reduce the environmental chemical burden that they carry so that there is less likelihood of having an impact on health. And the good news is that there are many, many resources people can use, and there's a lot that individuals can do. But I want to be sure to say that I strongly believe this cannot only be up to individuals, because we can't fully control our environment as individuals. We have to have government and industry play a role in assuring public health.
You know, that of course is the drum that, you know, I'm always beating on this program and in all my reporting is, you know, having reported on integrative health purely from a personal perspective for several decades, I've kind of shifted to, you know, focusing concern in those areas. Do most people realize this? People feel really overwhelmed by that. They feel that, you know, I think one of the big things, and one of the things that really struck me about your various titles in terms of the areas that you cover, is that, you know, one of the things is that you're a professor of public health. What happened to the public health function in our country? You know, we don't have a strong voice for public health standing there and intervening on our behalf. What is going on with that, and what's your feeling about what would be optimal or what needs to change in that arena?
Well, I agree with you. I think that in our society, when there is let's call it debate between industry and public health, industry usually wins. Mm-hmm. And we have not done a very good job of protecting the public health. And we can make that assessment when we look at the much tighter regulations that Canada to the north or European countries have imposed. They have been much stronger advocates of public health. Obviously, there's a myriad of reasons for that. I think that the lobbyists for industry are much, much stronger than the lobbyists for public health. I think that it has to do with parts of our culture that include our, you know, individualism. People should be able to sort of manage things themselves. I think there's lots and lots of reasons. But what we know is it is one worldwide ecosystem. The environmental chemicals are being found in places where the products never existed, you know, the Arctic, or they're being carried in the water and in the wind, and we are all in this together. So while there are certainly areas that have greater exposure, the Earth is one large ecosystem, and we really have to attend to this in a much more significant way. I have been attending to the increasing numbers of children born with autism, and when you look at the curve every year or two, the CDC keeps changing the numbers, and the most recent number was one child in 50 will be determined to have autism. And when I saw that, before that it was one in 86, before that it was one in about 110, it made me say to myself, when are we going to stand up and say, I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take this anymore? You know, mm-hmm. When will we as a people get angry enough that we say this is completely unacceptable? Because there are things we know that we could do to reduce the risk of autism. Some of them people can do individually, but some of them are really in the hands of our government, and I just am incredibly dismayed and frustrated that we are not, as a collective, taking greater action.
Well, I certainly agree with you. You know, one of the problems that it seems to me that we have is that every time there is this kind of this, what you're describing is evidence. In other words, there's evidence that there's a problem. But one of the things that when people raise the issue and say, you know, what can we be doing about this, what immediately happens is that there's a scientific debate or a scientific controversy, and then, you know, whomever is kind of saying this is a problem or this could be a problem or this plus this together might be a problem, you know, they get marginalized, and there's an apparent scientific debate about these various matters. And so people who do not have, you know, a child, you know, who is suffering, or, you know, a family member, or, you know, a close friend or whatever, will kind of feel that the issue is marginal to them, and very often, you know, become confused by this, but, you know, by this scientific controversy. I'd love for you to kind of just sort of dissect a little bit for our listeners what about this matter is controversial, or, you know, and where are we on the science in terms of really understanding how these, you know, a combination of different factors may be affecting the children to create something like this, as well as creating a whole range of worsening health problems throughout the life spectrum.
Right, and that last point, it isn't just babies who are affected. Mm-hmm. These increase all of our risks of breast cancer, of prostate cancer, of obesity, of heart disease. These are definitely issues for adults as well. The fetus is particularly vulnerable, but it affects all of us. I think the question about where we are in the science is a great question. So right now, we have a almost scientific fundamentalism, which is we honor above all the randomized controlled trial. Mm-hmm. We are never going to be able to do randomized controlled trials on the effects of environmental chemicals, because you would never be able to say this is ethical. You know, we could never say, well, let's expose half of pregnant women to persistent organopollutants and bisphenol A and phthalates and air pollution and pesticides, and let's give this other group of women an incredibly clean prenatal experience, and let's see over the next 20 years what happens to their children. That would never be done. It would be an unethical study. So all we can do is studies that sometimes are not considered to count as much. So we have studies that are done where we look at the effects of the chemical in a test tube and in scientific reactions. We have animal studies. We have accidental exposures when a disaster occurs. We sometimes have occupational exposures. So, for example, farm workers who are exposed to greater levels of pesticides by virtue of their work. We have various forms of data, but we don't have what is currently considered the strongest kind of data. Then there's the general way in which the scientific community works, which you described, which is you can almost always poke holes, even in the best randomized controlled trial. You can argue for a reason why it's not generalizable, or you can argue that the sample was too small. You can always find flaws in any study. And as you well know, what many people are arguing for is that in this field, we use the precautionary principle, which is, you could argue, a weaker level of evidence, where we're saying if there's the possibility that these chemicals might harm the public or our environment, then even without conclusive proof, the burden should fall upon those who are making the chemicals, you know, those who are using the chemicals or spreading the chemicals, that it won't be harmful. And we don't do that. There are 87,000 industrial chemicals in use today. Many of them grandfathered in. We have only had our FDA test about 200 of them, and only five were taken off the market. So imagine, you know, 87,000, five removed because of safety concerns. And even when things are removed, some of them can persist in the environment. So we're talking now about the overwhelming side of the environmental chemical story. I do at some moment want to get to the what can people do and how to manage that overwhelm.
Definitely, definitely. Well, we will be doing that on this program because you have a whole lot of information about that. But this is the context. Let's just talk a little bit more about science. Just I'm going to kind of bring in, you know, something. Because on the one hand, I think, for example, in certain areas, you know, there are a lot of people, you know, where there's some kind of claim for scientific consensus on certain issues. It, you know, something, it's either true or this is absolutely safe or we know this is no problem because science shows that. So there, you know, are people arguing for a certain kind of absolute, you know, there's closure on this and anyone who questions it is crazy or a woo-woo person or a marginal or an uninformed person or the equivalent of a science denier. And yet, on the other hand, we have, as you describe, a backlog of things we're simply not looking at from a scientific perspective. And I think that science is used almost as a marketer, you know, oh, we have the science on this case closed and it's sold to the public, where what you're describing is really there are huge gaps in the science of what we know and what we do not know. You know, just in the last couple of weeks, which I'd love your comment on, you know, the guidelines for use of statins were expanded to include a very sizable new portion of the population, healthy individuals without any prior indicators for cardiovascular illness. So, you know, there have been accusations and that the research for the use of statins for, you know, people who've never had a heart attack or any problem has been controversial. Now it's been expanded. The groups that govern these guidelines are tainted with self-interest. So, you know, what is the average person to conclude about science when it's used in all different kinds of ways, ignored selectively, you know, and different people are arguing for different kinds of science? How would you guide people in, you know, kind of clarifying their understanding for looking at this field of claims and counterclaims about science?
Well, I agree. We're in a really tricky time right now. There was an article published recently that looked at the top 39 selling pharmaceutical agents and the guidelines that had been written for a wide range of conditions, gastrointestinal, heart. And in the vast majority, there were significant conflicts of interest amongst the people writing the guidelines. Mm-hmm. And so on the one hand, we have this really big push for what's called evidence-based medicine and that people should follow guidelines. And on the other hand, we have guidelines who are being authored by people who stand to benefit personally because they receive large amounts of monies from those pharmaceutical companies as consultants or speakers. That is something we have to clean up. I think that guidelines can be useful, but I personally think that anyone who sits on one of those committees should not be allowed to accept any fees. You know, that should just be an automatic, you know, I have to excuse myself from this guideline because I have been a speaker for, I have received consulting funds from, I have received research dollars funds from. It just, you know, human nature being what it is, I think we've seen too much conflict. I also think that we often pay more attention to the potential benefit, and we don't necessarily weigh in the harm. So one of the things that I speak about when I speak about prevention is that we should
not use relative risks of something, which sounds something like, you know, if you take this statin medicine as an example, you'll reduce your risk of a heart attack by 50%, because that sounds so compelling. But if you were in the group where only, you know, 1 in 1,000 people was going to get a heart attack, even though you've reduced it by 50%, you've essentially exposed 999 people to a medicine that has some potential side effects. So statins aren't benign. We know that they can affect muscle function, and sometimes that's not reversible. They could affect liver function. There's some evidence that they increase the risk of diabetes in women. There's some evidence to suggest they affect cognitive function. And so I think when we weigh these things, it's not that statins aren't useful. Clearly, they're useful if someone's had a heart attack, which is, of course, the highest risk group, in helping to prevent a second heart attack. So this is not all drugs are bad, but it is. Let's be discerning, and let's look at number needed to treat. So that number needed to treat and that number needed to harm, I think, can really help. We don't know for sure what the right number is. For example, is it 100? Do you need to have one person in 100 benefit, and even if the other 99 don't? Well, I would argue, what's the harm of that? If you found something that had so little risk, you might say that's acceptable. But statins don't fall into the category of something with so little risk. Is it 1 in 15? Some people argue that the number needed to treat for prevention should be 1 in 15. Well, then I think there's also sharing this information in a way that individuals can really understand it so that they get to help make the decision. Because I'll tell you, having sat with many patients, the response varies. One person's going to say, my mother had that disease that you're trying to prevent. And even if there's only a 1 in 100 chance that that medicine will help me, I want to take it because I'd never want to go through what my mother went through. And the next person is going to say, really? 15 people have to take that for one to benefit? I hate taking medicines. There's no way I'm going to take that. So we can weigh in our own personal values and preferences when we're given the appropriate information. Also, often in these conversations, there is not enough attention that is paid to lifestyle. So we actually know that you can dramatically reduce the risk of a heart attack if you have a normal weight, eat a Mediterranean-style diet, don't smoke, maintain normal weight, manage your stress, manage your anger. All of these lifestyle factors can have an enormous effect on reducing the risk of a heart attack. But sometimes in the culture of medicine, when someone's given the prescription, it's like they're given a pass. Take this pill and you don't have to worry about the lifestyle things. The lifestyle things are actually more potent.
That brings us to, you know, something that we can begin discussing a little bit now, but we'll discuss more in the second half of the program. And that is, and so maybe we can just talk about it generally, and then when we take our station break, we'll get into more specifics, which I think will be very helpful for listeners in terms of what they can do as well. That then creates a very seamless rationale to look at lower risk of harm, interventions of various kinds that are milder, that are supportive, that deal with things before there's a level of acute illness. And this is really the rationale for both diet, lifestyle, as well as nutritional supplements. Can you describe, you know, and yet there's this kind of, again, another scientific controversy, should they be studied as if they were powerful drugs? You know, what is the role for and the risk factor for, you know, these kind of milder forms of treatment?
Well, the truth is they are getting studied the way medicines are studied, which I think in some ways is a good thing because it allows people like you and me to point to them and be able to say, this is a very effective test. And also it allows us to point to things and say, you know, this doesn't work so well. So we've recently seen, for example, the United States Preventive Task Force say, don't do PSA testing. You know, let's reduce the frequency with which we do mammograms because it turns out that they don't work quite as well as we thought. We have a study that was published more than 10 years ago now in the New England Journal of Medicine that basically showed if you're trying to prevent diabetes, the intensive lifestyle modification program worked better than metformin, which is one of the medicines that we use to manage insulin resistance, and better than placebo. In fact, they had to stop the study early because the intensive lifestyle reduced the risk of developing diabetes by 58%, the metformin only by 31%. And the review group basically said, this study is no longer ethical. You have to advise everyone do the intensive lifestyle because clearly that's the most effective. So we actually do have a certain, the number needed to treat, by the way, was 7. Just to keep to my own principle of trying to share numbers needed to treat. There was another study that was done also in diabetes. It was a much smaller study. The first one was about 3,000 people. This was a study of 200 people, 215. They were overweight, and they had just been diagnosed with type 2 diabetes. So they already had diabetes, but they'd never been treated. And basically, they randomized people to either have a Mediterranean diet or a low-fat diet, which, you know, as you will recall, was the diet for a long time we thought was a healthy diet. And it turned out that if you followed the Mediterranean diet, you were less likely, significantly less likely, to need to go on a medication than if you followed the low-fat diet. And there, the number needed to treat was 4. So while we don't have all the evidence we might want for every aspect of prevention, for example, I think the evidence in our mind-body, we don't have the same kind of level of numbers needed to treat as for dietary interventions. We do actually have very strong evidence. And the other point I'd like to make is something you alluded to, and that's that when you're making recommendations about things that are much safer, much lower risk, then you might decide that you could accept lower levels of evidence to recommend them. So I think that recommending that people have some kind of centering practice or self-regulation practice, relaxation practice, different language gets used for this, even though we don't have the same degree of evidence for it, we have very little evidence for the harm of developing that kind of relaxation practice. And so we might decide that we could accept different standards of evidence. Again, that precautionary principle for environmental chemicals, we might say there are things that we use, whether it's breath work or whether it's massage, for which we would accept a lower level of evidence than, for example, chemotherapy, which we know could be potentially toxic to someone. Well, we'd better have really good evidence before we recommend that someone go through a course of chemotherapy, that it's going to extend their life or be of value to them.
Yeah, that makes total sense. And, you know, again, therefore, when, you know, there's a statement, there is science and it's proven this, or there's no science and we don't know that, you know, it's like, what are you talking about? What is, you know, how potentially harmful is it? We should also calibrate the level of intense toxicity or harm to the level of science. We're time here now for our break, and we will be back after station identification. I want to ask our listeners to please stay with us for the second half of the show, and we'll be talking more about what individuals can do, both in terms of themselves as adults, their children, preconception, and all the rest of it, because Dr. Macis is a clinician with a lot of resources. So come back for the second half of Connect the Dots, and we look forward to hearing more then.
Welcome back, listeners, to the second half of Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy once again, here with you every Wednesday between 10 a.m. and 11 Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. We're in the second half of the show today, Connect the Dots, with Dr. Victoria Mazes, the Executive Director of the Arizona Center for Integrative Medicine and a Professor of Clinical Medicine, Family Medicine, and Public Health at the University of Arizona. Dr. Mazes is also the author of Be Fruitful, the Essential Guide to Maximizing Fertility and Giving Birth to a Healthy Child. We've been having a very interesting discussion today, and anyone tuning in now who's missed the first half of the program, I urge you to look for it in the Connect the Dots archives, where it'll be up in the next day or so. And if you're enjoying the show, please forward it to your friends and colleagues and like us on iTunes. I just want to give a shout out because over the next couple of weeks, we're having some other really terrific guests upcoming on the program. Next week, we'll be talking with Larry Dossey, the author of a wonderful new book called One Mind, about some of the body-mind aspects to all of this. And the week after that, I'm going to have as a guest Gabor Maté, who's going to be talking about new treatments for addiction and understanding addiction as a metaphor for many of the kinds of psychological and health problems that people in our society experience today. Today, again, we're talking to Victoria Mazes, and in the first half of the show, we were talking a lot about the context for health in the current environment and a lot of the things that are putting us at risk, and, you know, the need for a stronger public health function and a greater focus on all of the factors that impact health, as well as on the various lifestyle measures, supports, and interventions that really can help health. So I know people who've been listening are really eager to hear more from Dr. Mazes about the kinds of things that she advises everyone to consider doing and feel more comfortable with. So there's no need to feel overwhelmed. This is our reality, but there are constructive things we can do both on an activism level, which I promote regularly on this show, and if this is your first time hearing it, please tune back and check out our archives, but there are also personal things that you can do. So, Dr. Mazes, can you give our listeners some idea of the kinds of things they could undertake for themselves and their families that would be constructive?
Absolutely. So let me just start with a frame that I find useful, which is, the quote, the perfect is the enemy of the good. We can't create a perfect bubble for ourselves, but that doesn't mean that we can't really make things much better. I often recommend to my patients and when I speak that people begin by focusing on things they do daily or often. So, for example, most of us spend 8 hours or more in our bedroom. What can we do to make our bedroom a clean haven? That, for some people, might mean pulling up the carpet. It might mean moving your clock, which could be right next to your head all night and producing an electromagnetic field of its own, away from the head of your bed. It could mean in your bathroom and shower, what about the shampoo and conditioner you use every day? Could you choose a product that had fewer chemicals, less of the parabens or the sodium methyl sulfates, sodium lauryl sulfates? Could you choose a better moisturizer? Women, on average, use 12 personal care products a day, every day. So how about using Skin Deep, which is on the Environmental Working Group website, to evaluate some of those products and replace the ones, there may be something you're really attached to that you don't want to give up. Mascara is often one for women. It often has lead in it. But maybe you're not so attached to your body lotion. There are scented candles. Most of those candles have artificial fragrances in them. Do you really need a scented candle? Could you just use one that had no scent? Could you use essential oils instead of the artificial fragrances that we know have endocrine disrupting chemicals? So to do a self-assessment, and there are steps to do that. I include that on my website, which is victoriamazesmd.com. Things that you are doing daily, using daily, could you look at your office and make the same kind of set of decisions? Maybe it's worthwhile to you, depending on the environment you're in, to get an air purifying with a HEPA filter, a better vacuum. There are steps we can all take, and they can be gradual. We can gradually begin to develop better practices around these environmental chemicals so that we create a healthier and healthier environment for ourselves. But what we don't want to do is feel fearful of everything in the world.
Yeah, it's kind of a balancing act.
Correct.
You know, one of the things, too, is that, you know, I think when you begin and you just try doing a few things, it kind of gets a little less scary. You feel more empowered. Do you notice that with
I agree with you. And some of these steps, I want to say, are really easy, and and some of them are free. You know, one of the arguments we often get is that this is only for the people who are wealthy. You know, people who are wealthy can afford to eat organic. But let me give you one that I realized when I was writing the book. I really enjoy a good cup of coffee in the morning, and as I'm doing research for Be Fruitful, I started thinking about the fact that the coffee that I was making at home in my coffee filter, and it was organic free trade coffee, but that it's passing through this plastic tubing in the back of my coffee maker and probably picking up phthalates as it goes through and bisphenol A. And I bought myself a French press. That was a very easy step to take. Once I took it once, I didn't have to think about it a second time. It's just a new habit that I have. It wasn't a terribly expensive step to take. In fact, you know, I don't have to buy filters anymore, so it might, in the long run, save me a significant amount of money. And I actually like the taste of the coffee better. So that's just an example of one where it's a simple change. I live in Tucson, Arizona. It's hot. Most of us carry water. I have a stainless steel water bottle that I carry. That also allows me to bring my own filtered water from home and makes me much less dependent on water in plastic bottles, which are bad for the environment, which may be leaching bisphenol A into the water. So again, that's a small habit that once I developed becomes a permanent part of my world and exposes me to one less set of chemicals.
What about, I think those all sound like really fantastic things, and, you know, it makes a lot of sense, really, to just, you know, change things bit by bit, one thing at a time, and you're gradually reducing. What about this, the controversial subject of detoxifying? Is it possible, once these kinds of chemicals are within the body, to help the body get rid of them, to detoxify? Now, you know, the conventional view is that somehow the body can spontaneously, or, you know, that we're, that the detoxification pathways of the body are built in such a way that even though there's this massive onslaught in modern times of things that, you know, our bodies traditionally for centuries never had to deal with, the thought is that the body needs no help. What is your view on that?
Well, the very first step, if we want to detoxify, is to stop taking toxins into our body.
Of course.
And it does turn out, for some things, that alone is effective. So, for example, in 2011, in the Environmental Health Perspectives Journal, there was a study that looked at five families in San Francisco. And these lucky families had freshly prepared catered meals delivered to them with minimal use of any kind of plastic or can. And what they found is after just 3 days, the urinary level of bisphenol A in these families dropped by two-thirds, and the phthalate levels dropped as well. And so It is absolutely true that as we stop putting these toxic substances in our bodies can rid ourselves of them. And mm-hmm. some of them are water soluble and are easily excreted through urination. And if mm-hmm. we make changes where we, and this is one of the changes that has been recommended not just by me, but actually by the Royal College of Obstetrics and Gynecology, that pregnant women should avoid canned foods because of the bisphenol A and the liners. Mm-hmm. So there are things we can do if we want to detoxify that are evidence-based that have to do with stopping ingesting. There are other things we can do to support our body's detoxification system. So we detoxify in a lot of different ways. We can try to breathe fresher air, avoid air pollution to the extent we can. Well, we have a little recirculate button in our car. So if we're driving in traffic, we can press that recirculate, and we're not going to get the exhaust fumes from the car in front of us. A good habit would be you get in your car, if it's hot, you open the windows so that you allow whatever fumes might have off gas to get out and for air, fresh air to circulate. But then if indeed you're driving in an area where you think you're getting the exhaust fumes, use the recirculate button. You can increase exhalation by walking rapidly. So you're, you know, having more air exchange and through the fullness of your lungs. You can drink more fluids, which is going to make you urinate more. You can increase the fiber in your diet, which is going to increase your bowel movement regularity and move things in a more rapid fashion through your intestines so that you're exposed to fewer chemicals that are supposed to be excreted. And then the other way we detoxify is through our liver. And our liver in some ways is really a spectacular detoxifying organ. And there are things that we can do to help our liver function better. For example, eating cruciferous vegetables activates the phase 2 deconjugating functions of the liver. Other vegetables, beets, carrots, artichokes, there are dandelion tea helps the body detoxify. So there are things we can do. There are also some herbs that are very safe, like milk thistle or schisandra. Both of those are helpful for both liver and kidney detoxification. And then there are some detoxifying herbs that really should be used with the supervision of someone who's trained in either Chinese herbal medicine or Ayurveda or a naturopathic physician or an integrative physician, because they really could be unsafe, for example, if you became pregnant, and have to be used with care. So there are many different strategies that can be used. The detoxifying agents on the market, and there are many of them, have mostly not been well researched. So people should just be aware of that and should, you know, be savvy. If something promises to do everything, cure everything, act as a panacea, it is probably overpromising.
Mm-hmm. I want to point our listeners to your website, victoriamazesmd.com, and that's Victoria, V-I-C-T-O-R-I-A, Mazes, M-A-I-Z-E-S-M-D.com. You'll find a lot of advice and as well as discussion of a lot of the things that we are talking about today with Dr. Mazes on that website, and so it's a kind of ongoing, you know, source of information, as well as if you're thinking of conception, planning to conceive, also should, you know, do well to think about Dr. Mazes' book. You know, one of the things that I wanted to, and that book is Be Fruitful, The Essential Guide to Maximizing Fertility and Giving Birth to a Healthy Child. You know, one of the things, just to talk about, you know, some of the things we're extending our conversation about, some of the things that people can do, I'm guessing that some of this is the kind of thing that
people planning to have children can also do as part of preconception planning. Let's just talk, you know, we have about 5 or so minutes more to the show, but let's just touch in a little bit more about that. First of all, is preconception planning and doing the kind of cleanup that will help people have a healthy baby, you know, is that something that both mothers and fathers do? Is it just the mother? Is the mother more important? Can you just give our listeners a little bit of an idea about that? As well as, you know, and again, we only have about 4 or 5 minutes here, but, you know, how far in advance of, you know, trying to conceive might people think about doing the kinds of things you're talking about? Obviously, anyone can do them lifelong and should be doing them, but specifically for the people that would be, you know, seeking to have children.
Yes, so thank you for mentioning the website. I do think that it's a place for people to get further information. I review how to do an environmental self-assessment. I also point to the environmental health recommendations about food and how you store your food and personal care products and other practices, things we haven't yet talked about that you could do at home. People often want to paint the nursery. You know, be careful of the paint you choose. But I point to many, many wonderful resources, and that was one of the reasons I wanted to write Be Fruitful, is that there are so many wonderful ways that people can now self-assess and then find better products and better, you know, develop better habits so that they do reduce the risk of any negative impact on their future child's health. The question about duration is a great question, and this is both men and women. You know, for so long I think we have under-acknowledged the role of men's health in fertility. We know that men's health affects fertility in a variety of ways. Sperm counts have been dropping for decades. We do think that one of the reasons has to do with the environmental exposure to pesticides, some of which act as estrogen mimics and alter hormone levels in men, also heavy metals that men are exposed to that can affect sperm counts. We know that men who take a multivitamin, especially paying attention to folic acid, to zinc, that these can improve male sperm counts. Omega-3 has been shown to improve male sperm counts and also the morphology so that they're more normal functioning, normal looking, normal functioning sperm in men. But it turns out that in both men and women, it's about 4 months before conception that's the most critical period, because that's the period of time where sperm development happens, and it's also the amount of time that a developing egg in the follicle comes to maturity so that it is eventually popped out of the follicle and ovulated as a mature egg ready to be fertilized. So for people who really care and want to give the best possible shot for good health to their child, the 4 months before the conception is the most critical period.
Yeah, that makes sense. That's not really, I mean, that sounds very doable, actually. It's not like
I think it is doable. And I also think
so.
It's like this way in which we can make of ourselves the kind of vessel, the kind of container that honors what we are doing, which is creating new life. There's such a larger mystery to creating life. In fact, in the mystical tradition, it's said that there are three partners in conception, the father, the mother, and God. And so really, I think not only do you get to clean up your act from the perspective of environmental chemicals, but you get to consider what it means to you to be bringing life into the world. So I think it's lovely to have that period of time where that's what the focus is.
That really sounds wonderful, the whole concept of being a vessel, and really a beautiful understanding for people to have, both for physical health of themselves and the child, and also for the emotional and spiritual well-being. Well, we're coming down to the end of our show here. I just want to thank you so much for being with us today and Connect the Dots, Victoria Mazes. Please check out, listeners, her book, Be Fruitful, as well as her website, Victoria Mazes, MD. Thank you again, Dr. Mazes. Well, we'd love to have you back again. You are really an encyclopedia of wonderful information. And thank you, listeners, for being with us on Connect the Dots. If you missed any part of the program or would like to share it with your friends, please do so on iTunes. It'll be up in archives later today. I'm Allison Rose Levy, and I want to warmly invite you to join us again on Connect the Dots every Wednesday, 10 a.m. Eastern. Next week's show, we're going to be joined by Dr. Larry Dossey. So that's going to be a really fantastic program. And please tune in then. And thanks for tuning in today. Have a great week.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Mahuele, 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 mahu